What is a smell that reminds you of your childhood? Notice what just happened? I didn't ask you to think about your childhood. I asked about a smell. And yet, without your permission, your mind just went somewhere. Maybe to a kitchen, maybe to a backyard, maybe to a person who's no longer here. You didn't just go there. The question took you. Me? I went to stand in the grass of my central Arizona backyard and the distinct smell of rain. That's what we're exploring today, and what actually happens inside us when a question is asked. Not to ask better questions, not clever prompts or strategic inquiry, but the raw biological, neurological, emotional experience of being asked. Because questions don't just request information, they intervene. They take our attention. They alter our chemistry. They sometimes open doors we didn't intend to walk through, and occasionally, doors we'd rather keep closed. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, "Even the genius asks questions." Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I'm a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you're here. Ready? Let's duck inside. So here's the first thing to understand. When a question is posed, it tends to commandeer our attention. Neuroscientists sometimes refer to this reflective response as instinctive elaboration. Once a question enters awareness, the brain automatically begins working on it, not because we choose it, but because that's how the system is built. John Medina, a developmental molecular biologist, puts it simply in Brain Rules, "We are not wired for true multitasking. When we engage with an attention-heavy stimulus, like a direct question, other inputs get suppressed." So when I asked you about that childhood smell, I wasn't making a polite request. I was redirecting your cognitive machinery. Your brain dropped whatever else it was doing and began searching. And for that brief moment, the question crowded out everything else. It's not a metaphor, it's a mechanism. In a world saturated with distraction, a well-placed question cuts through because the brain treats questions as priority interrupts. Notifications can wait, headlines fade, even internal monologues pause. Think about what that means. When you ask someone a question, especially a direct one, you are temporarily becoming the center of their mental universe. Their brain reallocates resources towards the question, whether they want it to or not. That's power. And like all power, it carries responsibility. Consider how this shows up in everyday life. You're in a meeting, 7 people around the table. Attention is, well, fractured, half listening, half emailing, at least in their heads. Slides advance. Words fill the room, very little actually lands. Then someone asks a real question, not rhetorical, not performative, directed. "Sarah, what's your read on whether this timeline is realistic?" Watch what happens. Sarah's attention snaps to the present, but so does everyone else's, because a question has entered the room, and now every brain is tracking it, partly out of curiosity, partly because no one wants to be next. One question reorganized the attention of the entire room. Or consider parenting. How was school? rarely goes anywhere. The brain recognizes it as routine and responds with minimal effort. But ask, what's something that annoyed you today? Now, the brain has to search. It can't dismiss the questions as easily. The hijack works, but notice something important. The way the question is shaped determines the kind of thinking that follows. There's one more nuance here that matters. The brain prioritizes the most recent question it hears. If someone asks you a question, and before you can answer, another question is layered on top, the second one usually wins. Returning to the first takes conscious effort. This is why interruptions feel so jarring. You're not just being pulled away socially. Your cognitive machinery is being redirected mid-process. Arguments exploit this all the time. Why do you always do that? Your brain has no choice but to engage. You may want to stay on the original topic, but now you're defending yourself instead. The conversation has shifted, not because of dominance, but because of neurology. I didn't fully appreciate this until I started paying attention to my own questions. I realized I wasn't just gathering information, I was seizing cognitive resources. And that realization changed how carefully I choose where I point them. Next up is the chemical cascade. Once a question takes hold, attention isn't the only thing that shifts. Chemistry follows. Research suggests that engaging questions can activate multiple neuromodulatory systems associated with focus, motivation, and reward. Most notably, serotonin and dopamine. Serotonin is often associated with cognitive flexibility and emotional regulation. When a question feels approachable, when it invites exploration rather than threat, the brain appears to create conditions for calm, focused thought. This may help explain why a good question can feel like relief before it's answered. The system settles enough to think. Questions like, what's allowed to be unfinished here? Or, what don't I need to have figured out yet? Often feel like relief before they're answered. The system relaxes, not because the problem is solved, but because the question itself creates space to think. Then there's dopamine. Dopamine is often described as the brain's reward chemical, but that's only part of the story. It's more accurately tied to motivation and pursuit. Dopamine rises when there's something worth seeking. And this is where questions diverge. In some contexts, dopamine fuels curiosity. The brain leans forward. Searching feels energizing. In other contexts, dopamine amplifies fear. The brain braces. Searching feels risky. Same chemical, different interpretation. Researchers at UC Davis explored this in a now-famous curiosity study. Participants were shown trivia questions and scanned while anticipating the answers. When curiosity was high, when people generally wanted to know, the brain's reward circuitry lit up. The same regions associated with food, money, and other primary rewards. But here's the detail that stopped me when I first encountered this research. During the waiting period between question and answer, participants were shown random faces, completely unrelated information. Later, memory tests showed that those faces were remembered far better if they had been seen during moments of high curiosity. Curiosity didn't just enhance learning about the things people were curious about, it enhanced learning overall. The researchers described curiosity as creating a rising tide that lifts all boats. When the brain is genuinely engaged, the entire learning apparatus operates differently. This helps explain why great teachers don't start with answers. They start with questions that open a gap the brain wants to close. But dopamine also has a shadow side. The same motivational systems can register exposure, risk, evaluation. The brain is constantly asking, often below awareness, Is this question an opportunity or a test? Is this person curious or judging? Those judgments shape whether a question feels energizing or threatening. This is one reason opinion-based questions often land so well. Several imaging studies suggest that being asked what you think, not just what do you know, activates reward-related regions of the brain. There's a quiet pleasure in being invited to share perspectives. It signals you matter here. There's generosity in that. And there's another layer worth naming. Cognitive scientists sometimes describe humans as informivores, organisms that seek and consume information the way other species seek food. From an evolutionary standpoint, information has always meant survival. A question creates an information gap, and the brain experiences that gap as appetite, which brings us to what happens when the gap doesn't close. And this brings us to the open loop. In 1927, Soviet psychologist Bluma Zeigarnik noticed something peculiar in a Viennese cafe. Waiters recall unfinished orders with remarkable precision, but the moment a table paid, the details vanished. Her experiments revealed that what we now call the Zeigarnik effect. Unfinished tasks and unanswered questions remain more cognitively active than completed ones. When a question opens, the brain opens a mental file. If the question is answered, the file closes. If it isn't, tension remains. That tension keeps the question alive. This is why cliffhangers work, why unresolved conversations follow us home, why certain questions show up in the shower or at 3 a.m. in the morning. My signature question, "What question are you avoiding that would change everything?" rarely closes neatly. For many people, it opens a loop that stays open, and that's intentional. But here is where this becomes personal. During the afternoon of Sunday, March 21st, 2021, during my social justice walk through every street and alley in Washington, D.C., I encountered a question that remains open. As I approached a group of Black residents enjoying community, a conversation began. Most were supportive of my walking project, and yet one woman was agitated. She peppered me with questions. "Are you racist? What do you think about white supremacy? Why is it okay for you to walk our neighborhood, but I can't safely walk yours? Do you know how tired we are of dealing with this shit?" Her questions were righteous. While some questions had definitive answers, others were more ambiguous. But the question that primarily remained open for me is, what real difference are you making? I was nearly halfway through a project in which I logged over 4.1 million steps, walking through ice storms and sweltering August heat. I told her that completing the project would give me a seat at the table to challenge those who look like me, have more connections, and greater resources to use that power to bring about needed change. I could point back to how I invested what I had at my disposal as a marker for them to improve upon. Now, nearly 5 years later, the question remains open. This gift is a daily reminder and spurs me on toward an answer. Not every open loop is a burden. Some are invitations. Now, open loops can also be generative. They can drive creativity. They can protect what matters from being forgotten. But too many open loops create noise. Research shows that excessive unfinished cognitive business can impair sleep, increase rumination, and create a persistent sense of mental clutter. This is why external systems, journals, task lists, notes, are all so powerful. Writing something down often releases nearly as much tension as completing it. The brain gets permission to rest. Sometimes wisdom looks like holding a question. Other times, it looks like consciously releasing one. Knowing the difference matters. Next up is a threat response. Not all questions invite curiosity. Some trigger fear. Deep in the brain sits the amygdala, an ancient threat detection system. Its job is to assume danger and react fast. When it perceives a threat, it can suppress activity in the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain responsible for reasoning and nuance. Daniel Goleman famously referred to this as an amygdala hijack. The term is metaphorical, but the neural suppression is measurable. This is why certain questions derail conversations instantly. Why did you do it that way? Depending on context, that can be an inquiry or an accusation. The amygdala often can't tell the difference. Threat detection happens faster than conscious evaluation. By the time you realize a question was harmless, your body may already be tense. Heart rate up, shoulders tight, jaw clenched. This machinery evolved to keep us alive, not to help us navigating performance reviews or dinner table conversations. Certain words are especially volatile. Why is often the worst. Compare, why did you take that approach, with what led you to take that approach? Most people feel the difference immediately. Same information requested, completely different neurological invitation. Additionally, relationships matter. The same question from a trusted friend and a hostile colleague will land differently because the brain has learned who is safe, and this cuts both ways. When I feel that defensive surge now, I try to recognize it for what it is. I struggle with it, but I try. My amygdala is doing its job. Pausing for even 6 seconds can help. That's often enough time for the prefrontal cortex to come back online. 6 seconds. A breath. A chance to ask, is this actually a threat? Next up is the self in question. Some questions don't just ask for information, they ask for you. Neuroscientists refer to the default mode network, a set of brain regions active during self-reflection, memory, and identity construction. When a question turns inward, what do you believe? Who are you becoming? What would you regret not doing? This network activates. And here is the subtle but profound insight. The default mode network doesn't simply report on a fixed self. It helps construct the self, moment by moment, from memory, imagination, and interpretation. This means reflective questions don't just reveal who you are, they participate in shaping who you are. The woman's question, "What real difference are you making?" is still open for me. It shapes how I interpret the world and the choices I make. I intend to keep using my voice and take opportunities to share about the unlearning leading to the walk and how the experience changed me. I fully expect that question to be with me until I die. Rainer Maria Rilke once wrote about living the questions. He wasn't being poetic for effect. He was naming a psychological reality. When we sit with certain questions, we are reshaping the neural networks that constitute our sense of self. That's not just productivity. That's formation. Next up, now let's put it all together. So what happens when a question is asked? Attention is hijacked. Chemistry shifts. Loops open. Threat responses may activate. And sometimes the self is brought into question. Most of this happens in seconds. Much of it happens below awareness. And yet the effects ripple outwards, into relationships, decisions, and identity. This awareness has changed how I handle questions. When I ask one now, I'm aware that I'm doing something to someone. When I'm asked one, I try to notice what it's doing to me. And when I sit with the big questions, I remember that I'm not just seeking answers. I'm participating in the ongoing construction of myself. Questions are not neutral. They are interventions. They alter attention. They shift chemistry. They open loops that persist, and sometimes they quietly shape who we become. That opening question, the smell from your childhood, may already be gone. Or it may still be hovering. Either way, something happened when it was asked. So as you move through your day, notice the questions that find you. Notice what they do. And when you ask questions of others, remember what you know now. You're not just requesting information. You're intervening. You're shaping. You're inviting another human brain to stop everything else and turn towards you. What question is already working on you, whether you agreed to it or not? And that, friends, wraps up another episode. I'm grateful that you're part of the community. Drop in the comment section of your favorite podcast player the moments that will stick with you. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with the episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.